Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
For the last year, I've been waging an ongoing war, a trench war in every sense, against dysthymia, an acute mood disorder characterized by a chronic, low-grade feeling of depression. In simpler terms, once I used to wake up happy, and now I wake up sad. I'm not sure I know why. I have no idea how to shake it off, and I don't know how much longer Dikla can stand it. Lately, I've had the feeling that she's keeping her distance from me. Maybe she's afraid she'll catch it. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I'm talking to author Eshkol Nevo, author of The Last Interview, published in Hebrew in 2018. In this beautifully written and well-translated novel, an unnamed but famous author answers a set of interview questions that send him back in time to every mistake he's ever made. In answering the questions, he begins to understand how his words and actions over the years have hurt people and pushed away those he most loved. Now he's grappling with a daughter who won't speak to him, a best friend who's dying, and a wife who can no longer trust his ability to tell the truth. Hi, Eshkol. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Galit.
So, what inspired you to write your novel as a set of questions that the author answers?
Actually, I had a writer's block. I was working on another book, and I got stuck. And then I started playing this game. It was actually a game I decided to play with myself. It was not supposed to be a novel. I just thought to myself, it could be interesting to take all these questions I'm asked in interviews or during readings and answer them with the most honest, brutal, and non-politically correct answer I never had the courage to answer. So it started as a game, and slowly I realized that I'm writing a novel. There are characters, there's narrative, the motives. And when I realized it, of course, I started shaping it as a novel. But it began as a game in order to regain the joy of writing. And win over the writer's block.
Some of the interview questions seem a little nosy, like what kind of a kid you were, or what's your favorite word, which I loved, scandalmonger in English. Not sure if the Hebrew version sounds as cute, but were most of them questions that you'd been asked in interviews?
All of them. All of that was my rule, you know, as every game has its rules. My number one rule was I'm only answering questions I was really asked. And it's really, it's fascinating. What kind of questions can you get? Even questions like, do you believe in God? I was asked, do I believe in God during an event in Haifa? What kind of child you were is a very common question. There's one question in the last interview I actually wasn't asked myself. It was during a meet the author event in our creative writing school with another writer. Her name is Oli Kastel-Blum. She's an Israeli writer. And one of the students asked her the very funny, silly question, what was your record? How many pages were you able to write in one day? Because it's not that important, but at that moment I was writing the last interview, and I thought, yeah, it's really good for me, this question, because in that way I could speak about the letters the narrator, the main character, used to write his wife when he was traveling in South America. So I took this question. This is the only question in the book I wasn't asked myself.
Well, what's the answer?
The answer in the book is quite close to my real answer. The kind of letters I used to write, it was 1995. We're talking about no WhatsApp, no emails, no Skype. I had a girlfriend back in Israel. I was really into maintaining our relationship. So I would start writing at the morning, and I would keep on writing 2 or 3 days. And she would get 20, 30 pages, a combination of fiction and nonfiction. I guess this is my record in writing and letter writing.
And did those letters work? Is that your wife?
Yeah, it's kind of a romantic story. Yeah.
You end the last interview by writing that you quote, "won't rewrite, won't rethink, won't embellish." Not this time. So that implies that usually you do those things. Do you think you do more rewriting, rethinking, or embellishing than is usual for a writer?
First of all, it's of course I did rewrite and edit and think about this. It's kind of let's be honest, it's to make a novel out of a questionnaire in this format is not an easy task. It was challenging. It was challenging to editing it, how to maintain a level of intensity in plot wise, not only answers wise. So I did, of course, edit it, but I felt I'm taking a risk here in this book that I'm honest in a way I was never before. I'm non-politically correct in a way I wasn't before. I was writing a writer in first person. I never did that. I kind of never understood writers who write about writers. Mm-hmm. And I never thought I would do it. It's a book that is pretending to be autobiographical, which is another thing I never thought I would do. So I felt like I'm taking a risk here. And in many emotionally and artistically, and this is why I wrote these last sentences. Yes, I'm taking a risk. I know that. I'm kind of putting my life on the table, but I'm willing to take it. And okay, I'm sending it. And of course, it's also the question of the situation that the main character is, which is different than mine. He is in a crisis. He's in a big crisis in his life. For him, in a way, letting go of this text is equivalent to letting go of other elements in his life. Being able to say goodbye to his sick friend, being able to acknowledge the fact that his wife wants to leave him. So I guess these lines refer not only to the act of writing and editing, but also the act of letting go. Okay, now I'm letting go.
Mm-hmm. Your protagonist says that he suffers from dysthymia. Can you talk about how that affects him?
Yeah, it's good. Nobody talks about this, about dysthymia. It's amazing how many people, after the book, talked with me about it. The book was published already in Israel, in Italy, Germany, and France. And every place that it was published in, one of the first questions were, where did you get this idea to write about dysthymia? Or even more personal, my husband is just like that, but I never understood what it is until I read the book. So it's kind of a depression, but it's a minor depression. It's a kind of a melancholic state of mind that goes on for quite a while. And I think the main difference between dysthymia and depression, as far as I kind of know, is that when you are dysthymic, you are hungry, you are searching, you are not defeated. You still desire. You want to get out of it in a way. So I think I went through this kind of feeling when I was at my 40s, at the beginning of my 40s. So this is how I knew how to write about it. I knew this how it feels, and you know, it's one of the beautiful things about writing and novels and relationship with readers is that you find out that when you write about something personal as this, there's a lot of people who can connect to that, who can feel in a way that they are redeemed by reading that there's another person who felt like that and not the only one, and you feel less lonely. Of course, you know, loneliness is one of the problems that comes with modern life. So I'm happy I wrote about it. It was kind of, I felt kind of courageous writing about it. And this is what my character was going through. And I'm kind of, I feel very satisfied that from the reaction I'm getting from reading about this element.
Mm-hmm. You include a funny story about a very thick book that the author receives as a gift, and it doesn't fit in his luggage, so he leaves it. Was that based on a real story? Can you talk about it?
Yeah, I'm happy. I'm happy. You actually, meanwhile, you're mentioning all my favorite parts of the book. So definitely, this is a story about Marcus Hoffmann and his autobiography. The writer is book touring in Germany, and he gets this huge autobiography. It's 967 pages, and it's given to him as a gift. And of course, he has to accept it because Marcus Hoffmann was a Holocaust survivor, and of course, you know, you have to respect that. But then the book is so heavy, he can't get it in his suitcase, and he tries to get rid of it, but it comes back at him again and again and again. I think there's something extremely Jewish about this story. It's a story about how Israelis sometimes try to deny the fact that they are Jewish, but then you know their Judaism is coming back at them. But anyway, I had lots of fun writing it. It's, of course, it's based on a true situation, not a true story, a true situation. I'm giving a lot of presents during my book tours. People give me a lot of things, which is, of course, very generous. But, you know, then you have to come back home, and then you find yourself in the airport with an overweight. So you have to make this kind of tough decisions. So, I had lots of fun writing it, and it's my favorite piece to read out loud. When the book was published in Israel, this was my finishing note of every reading. I would just stand and reading, and people would laugh. And I remember my mother, like the book lounge we had in Jerusalem, in Mishkanot She'ananim. My mother was sitting in the first row, and she was laughing to tears from this story. And it's kind of a special satisfaction to see your mother so happy with something you wrote. So, this is the story about Marcus Hoffmann.
I also laughed out loud to myself. Okay.
I'm happy to hear.
So I think another favorite moment in the book, maybe my favorite one, was when the author's at a conference and he feels overwhelmed at the people with advanced degrees who are speaking about his book. And then he feels like he disappeared. Can you talk about that?
You know, the minute the book is finished, it's not yours anymore. And, you know, generally speaking, I'm quite happy with the way people read me. I'm reading now reviews published in the United States. It's kind of pre-publication reviews about the last interview, and I'm reading French reviews of translated French reviews, and I'm quite happy about the way they're reading this book, the level of understanding about this game of truth, lie, story that I'm doing in this game, in this book. But from once in a while, you can get a reviewer or an academic expert, or you can find yourself in a convention and people are talking about your book, and you're thinking, I don't know what they're talking about. Of course, it's there. You know, it's there. It's free. Everybody could say whatever he wants. But I did find myself in specific situations, you know, mainly within the academic world. Sometimes people take their own, you know, their own agendas, and they try to implicate them on your book. And sometimes it's relevant, and sometimes it's not that relevant. But who am I to say? You know, I'm just the writer. So, yeah. So then you can feel a bit, like you can ask yourself, what am I doing here? You know, they can interpret the book as whatever, however they like. And maybe the writer is not that important anymore once the book is published. It's only the book and the readers, whoever they are.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So music plays a big role. It's an ongoing theme. And you've told me you're a musician yourself, and I've told you that I was a classically trained musician. So my question, why David Bowie? Why Pink Floyd? Dolly Parton and Kenny Rogers? What?
Well, first of all, I have to, that's a confession. I'm not a musician. I just love music. I love communicating with musicians. Actually, I'm on my way, when we finish our talk, I'm on my way to a gig. It's kind of an online gig. It's happening live, but it's broadcasted online. We're in a lockdown now here in Israel. So I'm doing it together with a Israeli singer called Miriam Sika. And we're doing this combination of literature and music, and I've been doing it quite a lot. So I love the sense that I'm working with musicians. Also, I love the sense that, or to think that what I'm doing as a writer is music with words. Like I'm taking decisions, editing decisions according to the music, the rhythm. I took questions out of this book, of the last interview, because I felt they're ruining the rhythm. Some of the questions and answers were really great, but I felt the rhythm, they're ruining the rhythm. There's a rhythm, and it's destroyed if I put this question, this long question and answer here. So about my soundtrack, I'm sorry that it disappointed you, but but I think, you know, maybe there's an Israeli soundtrack to the book and there's an international soundtrack. So maybe my Israeli taste is more specific than my international one. Maybe I kind of remained in with the kind of music I liked when I was growing up regarding international music. But when it comes to Israeli music, I think the book is full with a great example. But actually, you know, Every book with his, sometimes it's a character, you know, it's not me. What am I, you know, Dikla likes David Bowie. What can I do? I try to talk with her. I try to convince her that, yeah, it's kind of cliche, but she, yeah, that's what she likes. And what can I say?
Right. The author writes that all the women he writes about are based on his wife. Can you say more about that?
Or I think the exact answer is, are based on three prototypes: my wife, the woman I would have married if I wouldn't marry my wife, and the woman that I am myself. I think that's the answer. But yes, I think I'm writing a lot of women, and I'm getting a lot of questions about it, like, why do you write women so much, and how do you write women? Of course, there's this discussion, which is kind of, I think it's more popular in America than here in Israel. But could you or should you write something that you are not? And for me, this is the basic fascination of fiction. This is my joy. I enjoy writing things that I'm not. So I enjoy writing women or a voice of a woman because I'm not. So I have a wife and I have three daughters. And sometimes I feel like a minority in my own house, and all I have to do is look around. I have so many examples around me. Look around, listen, pay attention, and then you can write a character of a woman. And of course, there's a woman inside of you. I think there's a woman inside of every man. There's a man inside of every woman, and you have to kind of get in touch with it when you write a woman. I specifically enjoyed in this book and in the last interview, this is kind of a long piece about the dreams that Dikla has, the notebook of dreams. And this was one of the most enjoyable pieces to write. I love writing dreams or inventing dreams or documenting dreams, and writing the dreams of the character, the wife of the writer, was challenging. I think I wrote at least 100 dreams, and eventually I chose the kind of 10 or 12 that seemed right for her. So if you can write a dream of someone, then you can maybe really understand him.
I could totally understand why their marriage was on the rocks. That was pretty clear. Mm. Was that fun to write?
Tell me what did you think? How did you read it?
Well, he was kind of a jackass the way he behaved. And if my husband came home with the kind of story that he came home with from Colombia, mm-hmm. I think Dikla was totally right. I was on her side.
I agree. I agree. I think it's always more complicated than that. First of all, I agree. I agree that this is the reaction, the right reaction. But I think it's always more complicated than that. When there's a marital crisis, it's not only one side who is to blame. I think it's a set of reactions to reactions to reactions that starts with something and then you can't stop it anymore. And it's. I think it's sometimes it's tragic because sometimes people who could love each other could have a happy life together ruin their marriage. And sometimes it's tragic on first sight, but it's in a way it's a redemption. I think when I think of the couple in this book, I think I think it's the right thing that they should break up, for her, for him. I think this is what should happen. Even though it's sad and it takes a while to understand, to acknowledge, I think he wasn't meaning it to happen. But this is the situation. Yeah, it was in a way. Writing my nightmare. When I wrote this book, I decided to be honest, even if it was honest fiction. And honest fiction means that when I answer a question of the book, I try to answer it, with things that even if they didn't happen, I'm really afraid that they will happen, or I really want them to happen. So if you write about your deepest fears, your deepest passions, then you are honest, even if it did not happen in real life. So I'm married, and my wife just came in while I was talking about your question or answering your question. She came into my room. But the things that I'm writing about, you know, it's not, I don't feel that they're distant to me. I see them around me all the time. It's a real challenge to maintain a happy marriage life for many years. Don't you think?
Okay, but I came away thinking that it's still possible. They never went to therapy. They never discussed it. They put all of that aside until mm-hmm. after the situation, you know, they had a time constraint and they put it all aside and they didn't deal with it yet. And it's still possible they'll get back together.
Okay.
I'm staying positive.
You're the reader. You decide. I completely let go. And I also think that you can never know. Like when it comes to love stories, my life has taught me that there's no, you never know. You know where you end the book, but you'd never know where you end the love story.
Let's talk a little bit more about Dikla. She does this aquatic massage. I had never heard of it. Watsu? Mm-hmm. But it's apparently a thing. I Googled it. And yeah, it's central to her life. Mm-hmm. And she is central to the author's life. So can you talk about how that relationship with Watsu affects his writing? He talks about it a lot.
It's, first of all, I highly recommend you and all our listeners to go to a Watsu or hydrotherapy session. I gave it to myself as a birthday present. I think it was 5 years ago. And since then, I'm totally addicted. Actually, one of the few things that are still allowed during the lockdown in Israel is going to hydrotherapy. So I can still meet my hydrotherapist. It's actually, you are holded in the water and you like a baby. And you close your eyes and you're completely weightless. And there's music if you want. And I think it's the most relaxing thing I ever did, and also inspiring, because many times during these sessions, it's like 50 minutes, 60 minutes, I have ideas for stories, for solutions to problems I have in a story. I have memories, I have understandings. I think you were talking about therapy before, about couple therapy. I think the more I get I wouldn't say older, but I'm coming of age, I find it less attractive or less of efficient to go to therapy that is verbal, that is based on word exchange. Maybe because I have become so eloquent in using words, I can sell a story even to my therapist. So when you are in the water, there are no words, there are no stories, it's just the body, and somehow every time we finish, my therapist tells me exactly what is happening just by listening to my body. So this is my experience, and it's funny, I wrote about it in the book. I gave it to the female character, to Dikla, as something that she does. And another thing that happened with this book, besides people discovering that their husband has dysthymia, is that people started, it was very, very successful in Israel. So people started going to hydrotherapy. And I find it harder to find a slot.
Oh, that's funny.
With my hydrotherapist. And then she tells me, yeah, everybody read your book. Why are you complaining? So, with Americans, it's easier. I can highly recommend it, and I would not pay the price of not finding a slot in my hydrotherapy place. And I think it's a way, I've come to respect the body more and more as I became a writer. Somehow I became a more attentive to my body since I started working with words, being an intellectual, teaching people creative writing. Somehow I respect the body more.
Another big theme is friendship. The author talks a lot about his friend Haggai, who disappeared, and about his other best friend whose brother disappeared. So friends and disappearing friends are big. And then you talk about the circle of friends. Can you go on about that?
The circle of friends?
Yes, circles of friends.
Mm.
It's something so interesting.
I think friendship, and specifically male friendship, is something I'm interested in my writing from day one. I have a book called World Cup Wishes, which is actually focusing on male friendship. And I felt when I started writing, I felt that in none of the books I'm reading, none of them is describing male friendship in the way that I know it. In Israel specifically, when you talk about male friendship, usually it's connected to the army. Army service, army, post-army experience, reserve duty. And Well, it was right, I guess, for a while, for the generation of my father, that male friendships were connected to the army, but it's not like that anymore. And I'm into writing about male friendship, which are based not on the need to survive together, this kind of enemy, but actually people who are interested in each other and find interesting things to talk about, and they are supportive, they share, they are there for each other. I have this group of friends. I actually talked with one of them because before I talked with you, and we tried to do something together to create this kind of a Zoom lecture together. He's an actor, and actors in Israel now have no work for 6 months now. Mm-hmm. So he's out of job, out of work, and we're trying to do something together and create this joint venture. And anyway, I'm interested in writing about it, and interested in many questions regarding friendship. You mentioned circles, like who do you feel really close to? Who do you tell your secrets? Who do you confess to? Sometimes if it's someone from, not from the first circle, but from the second circle, maybe it's easier. What do you do if a friend changes? What do you do if a friend marries a wife you can't stand? I'm really interested in that, and I write about it again and again. In a way, I'm writing about it in every book of mine. It's still a mystery to me. I think I write about things I try to understand, and friendship, it's still a mystery.
Mm-hmm. Still, to all of us.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I've come to, because of the lockdown, the quarantine, the isolation, I miss my friends so much. You know, I can't meet many of them. And there's one or two who live really close by, so I can, you know, I can walk with them, walk to them. But most of my friends, we haven't met for quite a while. We meet in demonstrations, you know. We demonstrate together against the prime minister. This is our meeting place. And now even demonstrations are not allowed anymore since yesterday. So... I miss them. So, you know, sometimes you write also about people you miss, just, you know, in order to recreate the sense of closeness through the words, through imagination.
Why don't you ever mention the author's name?
Because it's not me. It started as a autobiography, but then it became something else. It's fiction. It's not even autofiction. It's a combination of truth, lies, stories, what could have happened, what would have happened. And I felt that if I would use my own name, it would confine the book to what is written about me in Wikipedia. And it wouldn't be right. And if I would choose another name, a fictive name, it will also be a kind of missing the point. So it's open. You can identify the book with the writer, the narrator, and most important, with yourself as a reader. Find what do you connect to, where are the places that you can feel that are relevant to you, that you have, that echo something in your own life. This is, I think, the most important question. And if I had called the main character Eshkol Nevo, maybe I would prevent this beauty of projection, you know, that the reader projects himself into the book. I didn't want to ruin that.
So, Eshkol, I have about 10 more questions, but we're kind of out of time. So I'm hoping that another one of your books is going to be translated into English soon so that I can interview you again and ask the questions I didn't get to ask. What are you working on now?
I'm actually finishing. You mentioned before that you're writing thrillers.
Mysteries.
So I'm actually, for the first time in my life, my writing career, I'm trying to get in this genre of mysteries, thrillers, detective, but to play with it, because I'm not really interested in answering the question, who done it? I'm more interested in relationships, and, you know, friendships, in love, in family. So I'm trying to write a different kind of thriller, and I'm enjoying it because I'm playing with it. I finished my first draft, and now I'm editing, and I probably, you know, that editing is hell. A lot of remarks from my editor, from other readers who read the manuscript. So I'm kind of into this work, this kind of problem solving in the book, and I hope to finish it. I hope the cure, the vaccine for COVID will be arriving in Israel, I will publish my book. That's my decision.
Okay. Celebrate. It sounds like a plan, and I look forward to having it immediately translated into English so I can have you back. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for your beautiful questions. My first interview in the United States of America.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking with Eshkol Nevo, author of The Last Interview. If you enjoyed today's podcast and would like to discuss it further with me and other New Book Network listeners, please join us on Shuffle. Shuffle is an ad-free, invite-only network focused on the creativity community. As New Book Network listeners, you can get special access to conversations with a dynamic community of writers and literary enthusiasts. Sign up by going to www.shuffle.do/NBN/join.